This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. You've heard about proposals for a Medicare for All bill, which would fully replace your health insurance. The question is, can the United States afford such a thing? Robert Pollan is an economist. He is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and also the founding co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute. And Professor, you did an economic analysis of this type of health plan, correct?
Yes, with co-authors, I did.
One of the things that that Bernie Sanders was trying to convince people is that, in fact, a Medicare for All plan would not bankrupt the country. So you've done the calculation. How much would it cost per year to provide this kind of medical insurance to everybody?
Okay, well, before I get the actual number, let me just emphasize the critical point. It will cost less than we're currently paying for health care in the United States. Mm-hmm. That's the critical point. It'll save money relative to what we pay now. What we pay now is about $3.24 trillion in health care for people. That is about 17% of overall GDP. 70% of all the spending in the economy goes to healthcare now. Mm-hmm. According to our estimate, under Medicare for All, first of all, we cover everybody, so everybody gets covered, and there are no cost sharing, so people don't have to pay deductibles, they don't have to pay out of pocket, there's no co-payments. So even allowing for all that, we estimate that under Medicare for All, the entire system will cost $2.93 trillion. So we go from 3.24 to 2.93. So we save over $300 billion a year by transitioning to Medicare for All.
And this would mean that this covers you completely. So you wouldn't have any additional premiums, no supplemental plans, no Medicare Advantage plan, nothing like that.
That's right. It would cover everybody the same way that basic Medicare covers everybody now, for everybody who's over 65. So there would be no premiums, no copays, no deductibles. Everybody would be covered, and we would still save about 10% relative to what we are currently paying for health care in the United States today.
Okay. But in exchange for not having to pay any private insurance premiums, I assume there'd have to be a tax increase of some kind, right?
Yes. So instead of paying into private health care for premiums, we would pay into the U.S. government Medicare system. So, for example, the biggest source of revenue for the Medicare for All system, as we proposed the financing, would still come from businesses. So businesses now cover their workers. About 50% of all of the people, all of us in the United States, are now covered by someone in their family having insurance through their employer. So what we propose is that the employers would still pay in, they would still pay premiums. It would go into the big Medicare for All pot. It wouldn't be for just the workers that they themselves employ. But what we do is we set out a principle. We say all businesses, at least for the first years of the system, all businesses, whatever they're paying now in premiums, they all pay 8% less. So if a business is paying $100 now for its workers, the day Medicare for All starts, you pay $92. And we designed it that way explicitly to make clear the fact that Medicare for All will entail cost savings.
So built into this mechanism is a guaranteed lower payments for businesses. So they're paying 8% less than they are now in private insurance premiums.
Right. Now, of course, it does get a little more complicated because a lot of businesses right now don't cover their workers at all. And also there are differences between businesses in terms of ones that give high quality coverage to their employees versus low quality. So over time, we want to transition into something that levels the playing field. But to start the system, to keep things very simple And to make absolutely clear that this new system saves money, yes, we start out with the principle that if you are a business that are covering workers and you're paying, let's say, $100 or $1,000, it's going to be 8% less. So on $1,000 today, tomorrow when Medicare for All starts, you're down to $920.
Okay. That still leaves a revenue gap, though. So you have individual taxes on individual payers.
That's right.
That fill in the gap. So what are those other taxes then?
So what we have in addition to raise roughly the other $400 billion are three additional measures. One is a sales tax at 3.75% on non-necessities. So necessities, food, housing would not be taxed, so it would only be on non-necessities, and that would raise a little less than $200 billion.
Mm-hmm. And then, that, I presume, would be in addition to any state sales taxes that currently exist.
Yes,
right?
That would be on top of existing state sales taxes.
Right.
And then we have a net worth tax, a wealth tax, that would only apply to roughly the richest 10% of people. That would be at 0.38%, so less than one half of 1% wealth tax. And then finally, we propose that the treatment of long-term capital gains in the tax system be treated equal to the way we treat short-term capital gains now. Right now, long-term capital gains get better treatment for tax purposes. So we propose that long-term capital gains be treated equal to short-term capital gains, which means being treated the same as ordinary income. So when you combine those three additional measures, you get the remaining roughly $400 billion, and that finances the whole system.
So beyond those taxes, no change in the federal income tax rates for people?
No, we don't touch the federal income tax rates. I mean, you could obviously raise the revenue on the basis of income taxes, but we were really cognizant of trying to keep everything very, very simple. So under this plan, again, businesses would basically, like I said, just do what they're doing now, but just pay 8% less. A sales tax is very easy, at least for people administratively. You don't do anything. It's just when you buy non-necessities, you will have an additional 3.75% in your cost. And keep in mind, the necessities that we're talking about, food, housing, electricity, and so forth, that constitutes about 50% of spending for non-wealthy households. So effectively, the tax is only less than 2% given all spending.
Right. But that 3.75% sales tax would, for example, apply to the purchase of a new car.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
Okay. So that probably, it doesn't sound ruinous to an ordinary taxpayer. So let's look at the other end then. As part of this, you say overall spending on health care is reduced by, what would the number be now? It's some huge number.
Roughly 10%.
10%.
A little less than 10%.
Okay.
Yes.
So where does that money come from? Somebody in the healthcare business is either not going to have a job or is not going to be making as much as they did before, correct?
Absolutely. Very good description. Both things. So the main sources of savings when we move to Medicare for All are as follows. First, we think there are huge administrative savings from moving to a single payer with one set of rules that everybody understands. People don't have to fill out multiple forms. People don't have to decide from one private plan to another plan. All of that goes away. So what we find is that when we do this based on the research literature, we're not making any of this up, that the savings in administration would amount to about 9% of total system costs. Now, a lot of that savings, yes, is due to the fact that we need a lot fewer people to operate Medicare for All relative to the existing system. So we do talk about a just transition for workers in the private health insurance system, which we can talk about if you want in a minute. But the other sources of savings are lower pharmaceutical prices. We looked at pharmaceutical prices in other advanced economies, and on average, the other countries, they're paying about 50% less than we pay on pharmaceuticals, because the national health insurance systems in those countries bargain against the private health insurance companies, and they get the prices much lower. In fact, our own Veterans Administration also comes in at pharmaceutical prices between 40 and 80% lower, depending on the time and the study you look at. So on balance, we think you can lower pharmaceutical prices by about 40%. That would save 6% of total system costs. So we have 9% on administration, 6% on pharmaceutical prices. And the third big source of savings is that we establish Medicare fee rates for all providers, for doctors and dentists and hospitals. And that would save about 3% on total system costs. The doctors will come out roughly the same, because they're going to be released from a lot of wasted time on administration. So they will have more billable hours, even though their rates will be on average about 7% lower, because they'll be operating under Medicare rates.
Okay, so it sounds like you've thought about everything. I imagine the pharmaceutical companies will come back and say, well, if you cut our revenue by 40%, that means less research. Is that a viable objection?
Actually, no. We do cover that issue. We looked at the research on this question. Most, or let's say virtually all, of the innovation in terms of new drugs, new drug development, is financed by the federal government. What the pharmaceutical companies do is more or less swoop in at the tail end of the research projects and compete among each other in terms of how to market the newest innovation. So it's really quite the opposite. It's what's really happening now is that the pharmaceutical companies are benefiting from we taxpayers financing research into developing better drugs. And we should be financing research into developing better drugs. And that research funding will not go away. It's just that the benefits of that research will not accrue to the same exaggerated extent to the pharmaceuticals. Instead, they will benefit mostly the people who are actually financing the research.
Okay. Well, then, so you've handled that as well. Well, I guess that leaves one big problem, which is getting this accepted politically. Given the fight that occurred over Obamacare, which was basically preserving the current system, sort of shifting the chairs around, this does require a huge changeover. So what's the sales pitch to individuals, not individuals who might have voted for Bernie Sanders, but individuals who voted for Donald Trump?
Well, I think, you know, I don't really do this kind of polling, but I mean, if you read the polls, 70% of people are in favor of Medicare for all. Beyond the polls, if you look at our research, what we find is, you know, the biggest winners in transitioning to Medicare for all are middle class households. And I think a lot of middle class households voted for Donald Trump. If you look at the our figures on families who have to get their insurance on an individual basis as opposed to getting it through their employer, they're going to save 14% of their income by transitioning to Medicare for all. That means effectively their living standard goes up by 14%.
Right, but a similar promise was made by President Obama when we shifted to Obamacare, right? Originally they said we were going to save something like $2,000 on insurance premiums, and that became very difficult to prove.
Yeah, well, Obamacare, as you said, you know, really the premise was continued reliance on private health insurance, meaning that the private health insurance companies continued to administer most of the system and profit from it. There was no attempt whatsoever to control prices of pharmaceuticals. And those are, as I told you, those are the two main sources of savings. So yeah, in order for Medicare for All to succeed and to deliver higher living standards and better health care for the majority of people, we have to get those sources of savings. Now, it doesn't seem pie in the sky to me that we should when we see other countries that are already doing this. And so a lot of what we are proposing for Medicare for All is basically just following the example of other countries, and for that matter, a lot more modestly than they're doing. If we look at the other advanced economies, they spend about 9 to 11% of overall spending in their economy, GDP, on healthcare. We're spending 17%. Now, what we're saying under Medicare for All is that we're just going to go down to a little less than 16%. So we're still going to be spending more than all the other countries under the way we've proposed things. But at least it's not going to be going up. And the savings will accrue primarily to middle-class households and to businesses.
And the type of health care we'd get would not be what you see in Europe, which is frequently large wards with more than one or two or three patients in them and sort of very industrial-looking buildings. We'd still have an American standard of health care with birthing centers, you know, and suites and all the rest of this stuff?
Yes. There's the we haven't suggested any change at all with respect to the hospitals and what they look like. Or, in fact, we, you know, it's enshrined in the bill, and we demonstrate that it's perfectly possible that people keep their same providers. There's no reason to that anyone would have to change their doctors.
So doctors don't go on the federal payroll or anything. This is just the federal government paying for your own choice of doctor and hospital.
That's right. So the doctors, instead of sending bills to, you know, 23 different insurance companies that have different rules and they get challenged, they're dealing with only one insurance company, the Medicare for All system.
And you wouldn't have long waits for elective surgery like you hear about in Canada and the UK?
There's no reason why we would have to have any long waits, because we are, you know, the doctors on balance are going to make roughly the same amount that they're making now.
And but you would have many more people, though, trying to take advantage of that level of health care, wouldn't you? Because everybody would have insurance now. Nobody gets turned away.
Yeah. So here's what happens. So the doctors and staff, because they are spending, the doctors are spending about 8% of their week on administration. That's going to go down dramatically. So that frees them up more time treating patients. The staff, the nursing staff, is spending even a higher proportion of their overall time on administration. So actually, they will have a lot more time to treat patients, because they will be spending a lot less time on filling out forms.
So the only people who suffer are those who would be doing paperwork, and they will just have to find other jobs.
Yes, and we do take that seriously. Mm-hmm. When I presented this study last weekend at this conference, the Bernie Sanders, the Sanders Institute, I really insisted that any advocate of Medicare for All, which includes myself, we need to talk about a just transition for all of the administrative workers who will face displacement. So we have a very generous program that includes, first of all, protection of their pensions. Second of all, 100% wage insurance for 2.5 years if you're near retirement, 1 year if you're younger, and retraining and relocation support. And that's what it takes to get people into new jobs.
So has any candidate decided to pick up this idea and run with it, besides Bernie Sanders? Because I don't know if he's running
or not.
Well,
you know, the bill that we basically, you know, we were analyzing the overall idea of Medicare for All, but the bill we specifically focused on was the one proposed by Sanders. But there's like 20 members of the Senate that have already co-sponsored the bill. So it is, you know, it is not exactly far out there when, you know, nearly half of the U.S. senators on the Democratic side are already endorsing them.
Any Republicans at all interested in this?
Not that I know of. If you hear about one, you could tell me, but so far, nothing.
Well, the Republicans are all about saving money, and once we start seeing the these huge deficit numbers pile up, which we're already seeing, they're already talking about cutting back entitlements. It sounds like, assuming your figures hold, this would be a way to do that without cutting people off of health care.
Yeah. I mean, if you were, you know, you're a genuinely conservative person, as opposed to simply defending the interests of the health insurance companies, you would say a system that saves money for businesses, saves money for households, especially middle class households, would be something that conservatives could embrace, you know, creating more opportunities for businesses to spend time on innovation and creating better products and coming home with more money at the end of the day. That's what Medicare for All can deliver.
But the question you're going to get is, show me a single government program that lives up to hype like this, right?
Oh, well, Medicare. There we go. Medicare okay. for older people.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what is the administrative overhead of Medicare?
See, now Medicare overhead is only 2%. Overhead is 2% of overall costs, whereas if with the private insurance, it's more like 10%.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, Medicare gets gamed. We hear reports about that all the time. People have gone to jail for fraud against the Medicare system.
Well, look, there's no perfect system. And, of course, Medicare is imperfect. And so are all the systems in, you know, Canada, the U.K., Germany. You know, they're having a lot of fights over restructuring the U.K. system now. So, of course, no system is perfect. But on balance, if you look at, you know, again, polling evidence, people are highly satisfied in the U.S. with Medicare and have been since it was inaugurated in 1965.
By the way, does the fact that this plan was presented to the Sanders Institute indicate that he is in fact running?
I couldn't tell you that. I know a lot of people were suggesting that he runs over the weekend, yeah. And he didn't say one way or another.
Well, it sounds intriguing. And to your credit, this is the first time I've heard a specific program of taxes that would pay for this, because that's been the piece that has been missing so far.
Well, thank you. I mean, you know, we did spend a lot of time on this, and that's obviously we wanted to make, if we're going to bother to do all the work, we want to tell a credible right. story. And so explaining how the revenues get generated is central to having a credible story.
Absolutely. Robert Pollan is an economist and teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and is the founding co-director of its Political Economy Research Institute. Robert, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me on.